Good morning. Thanks for joining me today. We're going to be talking about a topic that I've been thinking about quite a bit, adaptability. 10 years ago, I had the special opportunity to learn from a highly regarded professor at my university for one of the mandatory classes that I had to take to get my political science degree. Originally, I had assumed it would be a full class, given that the last few this professor taught were so difficult to get into, I actually had to request special permission to get into it, and he allowed it. I had attended his previous lectures as well. They were on the prison system. They were really good. And I actually don't remember the name of this course, but I do remember him thinking outside of the box and helping me think outside of the box. He was one of the few professors that had actually kind of had this anti-establishment side to him without going too far. Obviously, when you're teaching in an institution, you can't really do that. When I showed up to this class, the theory and challenge class, I was one of the four students that had showed up. So his other class was full. This one was only four students. Basically, the outline of this course, and again, it kind of took me by surprise here, but the outline was that we had to read Marx every single week, Karl Marx, beginning with Das Kapital. And I think it was empty because this course was just so packed with readings and stuff like that. I don't think really anybody wanted it. And of course, a lot of people are looking for that easy A. This was not going to be what we were doing in this 12-week program. I guess the word challenge put a lot of people off. And you know, a lot of people were thinking about their master's applications and their grades, like I said. So that's probably why it was only four people in total. So the format was once a week. That was it. We'd have about 100 to 150 pages to read. And each week, we'd have a small roundtable discussion on it. It was one of the only times I truly was immersed into a subject fully. Obviously, college is a great time to look at Marx and Marxism, and that was definitely up my alley, just thinking about capitalism more purely. I was really into it. I was definitely hanging on this professor's every word. I thought maybe one day I could be like him. He was in his 70s, a little bit grumpy, but mostly just British. Definitely likable and definitely a guy I wanted to learn from. I tried to small talk with him a couple times, thinking we'd like connect on soccer or something like that, or for me it was some sort of low-hanging fruit that we could get a small conversation on. Did not go well. I was rebuffed pretty quickly. He did not seem interested in that kind of thing. He did seem interested in the material, our thoughts on it, and whether or not we were going to pursue this more seriously, but never anything outside of that. So it was pretty formal. By week 12, or by the end of the program, he did give us one opportunity to ask him a question, and I had to grab that with both hands. I was thinking, okay, here's my chance to really talk to this guy, to really learn one thing outside of this classroom, because again, it was so hard to get him to share anything personal about himself or anything like that. So I had to be fast when I came up with my response, but I thought about it for about 10 minutes while the others were asking questions. And I thought, you know, given that I'll be entering the workforce soon, given that I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life, well, maybe here's somebody who can help me. And so I asked him, you know, what is a piece of advice that you would give a young college graduate entering the market? And his answer, I'll never forget, his answer was, be adaptable. Now, originally, when he said that, I was a bit miffed. I was taken aback. I really had hoped it would be advice I could take with me, propel me in my career. I thought it would be some like ethos I would write down or something like that. I definitely had my own expectations, but it was definitely a letdown. I thought that he would go on some diatribe about the economy and tell me, no, you need to go into this specific industry so that you can be a millionaire. I guess I had the wrong expectations. I definitely was a little bit angry at first too. He was a tenured professor who had hit his established career, and he was financially sound, and he was full of great ideas, and I needed help. For weeks, even months, I found myself just stirring on it. I didn't realize it then, but this advice would come in handy, and it would be more career advice. It would be more career advice than I really thought it would ever be. It would be life advice that I would take with me for a very long time. I never forgot this one-liner. He did spend a little bit of time explaining it, although that kind of went over my head because I was so angry. at his original response, be adaptable. Wow, thank you so much, right? Because it just puzzled me. I felt like that was kind of a waste of a question. And you know what? As I grew older, I started to appreciate this a lot more. The first thing I'll say on that, and we'll get into why this statement was so powerful, but to begin this topic on adaptability, a fixed mindset is the opposite of growth. And in order to succeed, it is crucial to be adaptable. Throughout my life, I've been faced with many challenges or many chances to adapt the way I see them. The choice may not have been clear at the time, but accepting change and working within this sort of thing has been a huge part of my ethos ever since I started to understand my professor's words. Often in life, we run into situations and events that challenge the concepts and ideas we hold dear. This has happened to me many times. And every failure along the way is an opportunity to adapt. To be truly great at something, you kind of need to suck. When you look at it this way, sucking at something worthwhile, a new change, a challenge, a problem you're trying to solve, a skill that you're learning for the first time, is better than being great at something that no longer exists, especially a job that's no longer relevant, for example. Momentum is also one hell of a, momentum is one hell of a motivator. Sometimes accepting change can come with something amazing. It explains why innovation is so highly regarded in our world. When we're talking about adaptability, I do think the skill is the most underrated out of all the soft skills in market today. We are seeing an incredible shift in this economy with both AI tools and traditional jobs, seeing tremendous changes, growth, responsibilities changing, the entire understanding of that job is changing. Take what I do for an instance. The sales world has been forever changed by the introduction of hyper-competitive landscapes driven by automation and AI. Typically, the average sales rep has a reasonable ground to cover. He or she was expected to make around $100 a day on average. And this was usually mixed with email outreach and a growing challenge or channel of social selling on LinkedIn or other platforms. You've got email in there, you've got a few other things. Fast forward to today, and you literally have AI agents that can presumably replicate this entire job function. I'm not saying well, but even if you look at the development of these over the last year, it's incredible to see. Now, one singular rep, one person can cover about 10 times the amount of people using the suite of tools that are integrated to minimize the minutia, but also maximize some of the actual selling time. Others have created cadences, marketing automations. This can really go away with about 90% of the activity that traditional sales roles used to be covering. It has changed completely. What this would lead to is likely a reduction in headcount, a lessening need overall of a total number of reps in a company. It may even branch out further to encompass a change in how this job is considered, performed, and thought of. It may even change the compensation. So clearly the game has changed in my world and significantly for a lot of people in market right now, looking directly at their next roles. Another shift we are seeing is the same sort of mass activity scaled by AI, right? In this case, we're seeing the job market as well. We've had a tandem of ruthless economic times, mass layoffs, AI influencing how people interact. Folks are using AI to edit their LinkedIn profiles, enhance their resumes, write customized cover letters, even taking the role of reaching out to recruiters via the same sales process I just defined. This has flooded the market with more and more people, applications, jobs, careers, and it's only getting worse. Now, I've covered this in other episodes, but these changes are examples of larger market shifts. They're also compounding to fuel these runaway systems. AI has allowed big corporations to lay off about 5 to 10% of staff. These people hit the open market. They leverage AI and now they're flooding job applications. They stiffen the competition for the jobs available in market, which AI has a role in reducing. This is creating a rather nasty feedback loop where entire careers may actually be swallowed up. Suffice to say, one clear antidote to this is adaptability. If you are overwhelmed by a feeling of dread, fearing job loss, career evaporations, increased pressure to stay employed, now is the time to get creative, to be adaptable. And that's what I'll say on that to begin. History has a lot to say about this, and that's kind of where I'd like to bring some ideas from some of the more recent readings I've been doing. There are a lot of examples of people being creative in the face of adversity. I'll just get into a couple that I really like that I feel would be really helpful in making this point. I'm a big history nerd, as you'll probably discover throughout listening to me and then hearing me out. I love to bring in little aspects here and there, and my goal isn't to be a subject matter expert on any topic I cover, but to bring in a few things that are sticking out to me in the readings that I'm doing and in my general research, right? One of the most interesting stories I've heard recently is the work of David Graham. He's a nonfiction writer, but he has a great way of wrapping up these tales as stories. It almost reads like a fiction. And one of the most interesting stories that I read from him recently was The Wager. And that's a story of a shipwreck where men were sent across the world trying to find a Spanish galleon in Chile, and they actually had to sail from England all the way to Brazil and then through the Drake's Passage all the way to the other side of Chile. They ended up getting stranded, having almost no way to return home. They had to make shift and create a new ship, and that allowed them to get back home, right? You know, he has another story as well of the lost city of Zed, or Z, as the author would call it. The main character is one of those guys who went at the Amazon trying to discover a lost race of people, a lost city of gold. It is helpful to remember that humans have certainly faced times of great uncertainty, and when they're faced with life-threatening circumstances, you really see them adapt. In the case of The Wager, the fact that these men actually went and built a new ship and got themselves home, I mean, that should clearly demonstrate what I'm trying to say about being adaptable. If they were at any point accepting of their fate, we would never have heard that story, right? I'm not going to go through the whole thing. It actually is coming out next year as a movie starring Leo DiCaprio, so stay tuned for that one. It's The Wager, that actual book. The other one, The Lost City of Z, I don't know if they'll make this one into a movie, but same sort of idea. The main character is literally a British guy who went into the Amazon several times, and each time he kind of took the lay of the land and made his plan after the fact. He eventually did disappear in the wilderness, so I don't want to champion that guy too much, but in reading these tales, you kind of remember that people have always been adaptive, and you know, when we have this current state of play in our society, we tend to think of things as very fixed. I go to work, I do these things, here's how I pay my bills, here's my interaction with the world. But the more you study history, the more you realize that things are never fixed. They're always in a state of flux, right? And when you zoom out, this is very clear. In the case of these men in the 1750s who were traveling across the world, they had none of the modern accoutrements of our life, and they came up with something remarkable and possible and definitely a memorable story, right? I'll give you another example. I really, really like the nomadic tribes of the Americas, the Comanche tribes, the Shoshone tribes, and many of the other ones. And I'm definitely really new to this topic, but one of the most amazing stories more recently came to me through the works of Empire of the Summer Moon. And that talks about the Comanche tribe who ended up dominating the American Midwest for about 100 years, give or take, after they discovered the invention of horses. And that's a remarkable tale. Again, don't know if I have the background or even all the data to really break this down for you. But in layman's terms, here you had a tribe, the Comanche tribe, who was more or less scavengers, more or less people living on a mountainside, a hilltop, who were rather fixed in how they interacted with the world. They were forced off their ancestral land through the warring tribes. I can't remember which tribe actually forced them out of the land. And this led them to the plains that the Spanish dominated. The Spaniards enslaved them. And one of the things that ended up happening was that the Spanish brought over their horses that were not present in North America. And the Comanches were one of the stewards of these horses. They learned the way of the horse. They learned how to understand them. Fast forward 200 years and you have the most deadly horseback tribe in North America. If that group of people were fixed or rigid in their understanding of their environment, of their future, and of their position in the world, they would never have embraced that new technology, and they ended up being the native tribe that best leveraged the horse in their life. So I really like that. I really like how they went from being kicked around a little bit by other tribes and the Spanish to then being the ones that were feared by basically everybody in the area. So if you're interested in that, Empire of the Summer Moon, incredible book. Incredible book. There's a couple others I'm going to reference here too. I'm a big Robert Greene guy. And throughout the dozens of examples that he throws out there, the one that sticks out the most is obviously Napoleon. Going into each battle with a new set of plans based on the conditions and the setting of said battle. It makes my point for me. Rigidity is not going to breed success. Fluidity often reveals the path forward in difficult times. In regular times, maybe not, but when things get really sticky, it's important for you to be fluid and to understand, okay, well, what can change and what are some assumptions that I'm laying down that don't necessarily need to be present? If things are ever more volatile, unpredictable, consistently inconsistent, this may be an indication that things really are changing. This may be a clue that sticking to an old paradigm or old principle, staying stuck in one's assessment of the situation, might not be the best strategy, right? And, you know, I'm not done pulling out sources here. I've got one more for you. And this is the work of Napoleon Hill, who obviously isn't writing anything new, but I felt that a lot of what he brings in his book, Think and Grow Rich, has many principles of adaptability that I felt would be really fitting for this episode. The first one being definiteness of purpose plus flexibility of plans. I'm not saying that you should have no goals, that nothing should be fixed at all. What Hill says as well is that a clear goal is essential. So having an end goal is incredibly important, but the path to achieving it might be fluid and must be fluid in his case. He writes, "No one has ever been defeated until defeat has been accepted as a reality." If one plan, and if your plan fails, create another, and another, and another until success is achieved. Rigid thinking leads to failure. Saying I'm failing, saying this isn't going to work, is an aspect of failure. So you got to be adaptive in that way. He also talks about the mastermind group. Surrounding yourself with people who challenge your thinking fosters adaptive learning. Everybody knows the value of a friend who can tell you like it is, and that doesn't feed you that, I don't know, regular monotonous comment that isn't really valuable. We all appreciate people in our lives who can call us out or help us think differently. So I'd encourage you to surround yourself with some people who really think differently than you do so that you can break out of that agreeingness all the time or are thinking that things are so rigid, right? Especially when you have these kinds of friends, if one approach isn't working, you know, that kind of group can be called upon to come up with something a little bit more creative. So find those anarchists, find those people that think almost the opposite of the way that you do, and you might be surprised. They can help you run past some of your ideas in a way that you hadn't thought of before. Another thing that Hill talks about is faith and autosuggestion. When you have faith, it's not just about believing in success, it's about believing in your ability to adjust. So knowing that, okay, I am going to be that thing. If you say you want to be a millionaire, I'm going to be a millionaire. But when you're hit with a failure or a setback, not being blind in your adaptation of that understanding. If you learn something along the way, you should be applying that. You shouldn't just stay rigid. Of course, the best laid plans don't always exist at the start. So if you're starting out something, you're laying out plans, maybe you learn something along the way that allows you to be a bit more fluid, right? And so that's what Hill is talking about. He also talks about the subconscious mind, and it's trained through auto-suggestion, reinforcing a mindset that welcomes change instead of fearing it. So if you can actually foster a fluid mindset, an open-minded setting, and a clear intention of the outcomes that you're looking to achieve, that's how you can apply adaptiveness, on any product or passion or project, right? If you learn from temporary defeat, that's another thing Hill talks about quite a bit. For adversity, every failure, every heartbreak carries with it the seed of equal or greater benefit. And I kind of said that earlier, although I really do believe Hill nails it. And he talks about this, you know, adapting to setbacks is really key. Those who take failure as a final loss are certainly doomed to live by that final failure. But those who see failure as information and adjust always win, right? He also talks about adaptability as a core theme, and he definitely goes into a few other details as well. When we talk about Henry Ford, right? He tells that story of Henry Ford, who insisted on producing the Model T long after the market demanded innovation. Eventually, competitors forced Ford to adapt or die. He does redesign his production strategy. He did prove that even the most brilliant ideas must evolve, right? And if that weren't the case, Ford wouldn't be around today because they'd still be making the Model T. So obviously, you know, even the most rigid or monolithic billionaire success stories from our time, they have had to make great adaptions as well. Adversity is also a tool for reinvention when we're talking about Hill's works, the Great Depression being the thesis of that book, or the reason Hill wrote it. Hill saw countless individuals lose their livelihoods, but those who pivoted to new industries, developed new skills, redefined their value in the marketplace, thrived while others perished. And that is a real big point. And I think that's probably the reason I made this episode when I did and in current times, is because I do believe we're in one of those great shifts. This is going to be a theme with most of the things I talk about. We are in this time of AI. We're in this time of great adversity. As I discuss this, we're in the middle of a tariff war between Canada and the USA. So obviously, this is a time of turmoil, of change, and of new directions. And Hill talks about the Great Depression. I don't know if we're going to see that level of despair. Hopefully not. But these new technologies and these market shifts present themselves as much of an opportunity as they do a heartbreak for some, right? If industries are going away, livelihoods are lost, that also might open another door in another field, or it might also push someone to do something they wouldn't have done before. Plenty of success stories begin with a failure. So that's what Hill's getting at as well. He also introduces the idea of infinite intelligence, the ability to tap into the collective wisdom of the world, right? Hill believed that solutions and ideas already exist. You just have to be open to receiving them through study, experience, and your network. One of the greatest examples he gives is Edwin Barnes, who really wanted to work with Thomas Edison, but adapted his approach multiple times until he found an opening. He didn't insist on being hired as a partner from the start. Instead, he took a lowly job with Edison and eventually worked his way up. When he eventually did get the favor of Thomas Edison, it was remarkable how he was willing to put his head down and work his way all the way up. So Barnes set out with a final goal. He wanted to work with his hero, Edison. He probably didn't get there the way he wanted to. Edison didn't just call him up and offer him the job and tell him what a great inventor he must be. He had to wait for it. But by adapting his approach and combining it with his clear desire and intentions, he was able to find a way to get what he wanted. And in that way, the universe is a crazy thing. When you give everything and you're open-minded as well, sometimes things like this can happen. So definitely the reason I'm bringing Hill into this is because he covers this way better than maybe even I can. And that's why I like it so much, is because he has plenty more examples as well. But Barnes is a good one because he set out with this goal and he eventually accomplished it. Again, not the way he set out to, but at the end of the day, he probably didn't care, right? Applied faith and resilience in the face of uncertainty is the final point that I'd really like to touch on from Hill. In Hill's philosophy, it's not just a belief in success, but a belief in one's ability to adjust. He saw failure as a temporary setback, not a permanent defeat. I've said that a couple times already. Those who failed were usually those who refused to adapt. The 3 feet from gold story is probably the most remarkable that Hill offers. It's talking about a miner who quit digging before striking gold. He buys this abandoned mine that apparently has gold. He worked it, he spent his life savings on it, and after so many months of not finding gold, he eventually declared the project to be a bust. The new owner of the mine struck gold within 3 feet of where the previous owner had left off. So in that example, Hill is also trying to talk about, you know, don't give up on things, but those who adjust their approach often do get what they're looking for. And in this case, the 3 feet from gold story was used to illustrate somebody who did not adapt, who did declare defeat, who said, nope, there's no way I can get gold out of this. with a little bit more persistence combined with adaptability, maybe digging in a different spot or maybe taking a break for a little while and coming back. Instead, he just said, nope, I'm not doing it. It's not going to yield us any gold at all. And the new owner reaped all the benefits that he had spent his entire life on. That same person, although that name escapes me, went on to have a very successful career on the premise that I'll never ever let any opportunity go again. I'm going to pursue it to the fullest. So at least that lesson was learned, right? Hill has some great points. And, you know, bringing together a few of the other examples from David Grand's works, The Wager, The Lost City of Z, The Empire of the Summer Moon, and The Comanches, we now have a few different examples of what I'm trying to illustrate, right? When we're talking about adaptability itself, I thought I'd just bring up some key components of it, because we've talked about a few stories from my side, a little bit of evidence, and we do have a central theme developing here, but I'd like to break down now a couple of different components, right? These are the things I think you should have if you're trying to be more adaptable. You should try and better. The first one is emotional intelligence. Understanding and managing one's emotions, as well as empathizing with others, facilitates smoother navigation. Being flexible is obviously another one. Being open to new ideas and approaches allows individuals to adjust their strategies. Problem-solving skills and interpersonal skills are also part of this. So being innovative and creative in your thinking, being effective communicator as well, being somebody who's open-minded and a good listener is a great aspect of adaptability. So I would say those three, emotional intelligence, flexibility, and then your problem-solving and interpersonal skills are all in tandem the skills that you would need to be adaptable. When you're looking to develop or cultivate these kinds of things, I would say that you should be embracing continuous learning. Now, that looks different for everybody, and we all have different interests and subject matters that we like to do, that we don't like to spend time on. So just regularly updating your skills and knowledge prepares individuals for unexpected changes, obviously. The second thing, cultivating a growth mindset. Viewing challenges as opportunities for growth, it's really central to what we're trying to accomplish, right? If you're not growing, you're probably not going to get what you want. Now, a lot of people with that fixed mindset, you see them all the time, and you see them get defeated quite a bit. That's when the adaptability can be placed in, where you could actually grow and you could actually have a mindset where, no, I'm going to learn, or I've had a failure, it's time to rebuild from there, right? That's a growth mindset. Another aspect of this would be mindfulness, staying present, managing stress, meditating, understanding your emotions. All of those things are key to this as well. If you're in a fight or flight or constantly stressed environment, it's going to be really hard to be adaptable. It's not something that comes easily to people who are hungry, stressed, scared. All of those things are the antithesis of adaptability, right? Finally, you should be seeking diverse perspectives, engaging with different people. I said this before with your master group or your friend group. They should be full of people that are challenging you and getting you to think outside of the box. So those are the key aspects to develop it, embracing your new learning, cultivating a growth mindset, being mindful, and then seeking diverse perspectives. All of those in tandem can help you get better at being adaptable, which is a weird thing to say because it's hard to define, although we've tried today. But one of the things you can do is also define this for yourself. So these are things that I would recommend for developing adaptability, but it would be weird to kind of define that in a sense, because the whole essence and ethos of being adaptable is to define that for yourself, right? Different animals in different kingdoms, they do different things to adapt to their environment. No one way is better than any. It is just the way to get you to the next step, right? Often, as is the case, someone from history makes my point a little bit better than me. And finally, I'd like to bring in a proverb that I really like that I read recently from the Tao, chapter 76. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole book, but this passage in writing this episode came to me in a funny way, and I thought, you know what, it would be weird not to include it. So the passage goes as follows. When a man is born, he is tender and weak. At death, he is hard and stiff. When the things and plants are alive, they are soft and supple. When they are dead, they are brittle and dry. Therefore, hardness and stiffness are the companions of death, and softness and gentleness are the companions of life. Therefore, when an army is headstrong, it will lose in battle. When a tree is hard, it will be cut down. The big and strong belong underneath. The gentle and weak belong at the top. So clearly, if you're reading into that, you can see how or why I would have included this passage in this episode. But this author says it the exact same way I would. Things that are soft and supple are alive. Being malleable, being fluid, being weak, these are good things when we're talking about adaptability. We don't necessarily want to be stiff. I mean, if you look at how hard a material might be to penetrate, when we think about wood, it's tough to get through. You're not bending it. If you bend it, it will break. When we are approaching our life's philosophy and we are approaching situations in our life, you cannot be rigid. This is what I'm trying to say. And in Tao, they make that point a little bit better than I could. But yeah, I mean, essentially when we're looking at this, if you are fluid and you are malleable, this is the way to be in terms of life, in terms of battle, and in your army side, which is a metaphor for life and the life's problems that come, especially when we're talking about Chinese philosophy, which is where this poem is from. But in general, softness and gentleness are things of virtue when we're discussing adaptability, right? So I'm sure you're wondering, you know, what does this mean for me, and how have I leveraged adaptability? Here I am talking about 10 different things, 10 different ways to talk about this topic. I have truly been able to embrace these principles in my life, which is why I'm sharing them with you. Most of what I want to talk about are things that I know, that I've done, that I've experienced, and that hold true to me. Otherwise, it would seem like I'm just talking about nothing, right? In terms of my career, I've been a DJ, I've been a groundskeeper, I've been a construction laborer, I've been an office assistant, sales clerk, paving supervisor, I worked for my family business, and then I went back into sales where I've been for the last 5 years. Each time I started, I sucked at that role. Maybe except for my last one where I had a bit of momentum going into it, but once I sucked so badly that it almost took me out for good at my first sales job. And what I'm trying to say here is, although I've switched industries about 3 different times and I've had about 8 different jobs, these principles have always held true whether you like it or not. I definitely didn't approach it philosophically either. I never had this mindset that I've developed over the years at the beginning. It took some time. It took some heartbreak. It took some failure. But I was just trying to survive and get ahead. So I was willing to do different things. And at different points in my life, I just threw caution to the wind and said, you know what, let's try it. Let's be open-minded. Let's see where this takes me. It wasn't always about survival. And learning new things at work suddenly became a lot more commonplace and a lot more fun. This led to more development and for me to see things more procedurally. When you start something new so many different times, you can begin to look at new things as a box. Okay, here's what I need to learn on day one. Here's some things I can improve on. But as you continually do new things, you start to develop your own learn or your own way to learn. I like to think of it as your own learning how to learn. And in this way, if you can teach yourself how to learn things, then you can approach so many new topics in your own way, right? So for me, when this clicked in my head, I was thinking, okay, so what do I want to learn now? Because I've been able to challenge myself to learn how to be successful in jobs I hated, jobs I never even wanted to do. So what should I be putting this into now? And when we look at the principles of adaptability, this is clear. If you're open-minded, that's the first step to being successful at anything. If you're willing to change, if you're looking inside and you're saying, okay, well, I'm not really great at this, but I can tell that this will be important in the future, and I'd like to dive into it. That's what I'm trying to get at. So if you're wondering some of the things that you can take away or you can personally implement in your life, I would say the first thing is, it's tough to have a rigid definition of adaptability. The key is to define this for yourself. Pick and choose from some of the topics I've covered today what this means from you. Obviously, it's a mixture of some fluidity in one's approach, but it is also about resiliency in the face of uncertain times or failure. When things seem too insurmountable as well, that may be a sign that change is needed. My rule, if something has too many difficulties associated with it, it might be a sign to move on or adapt. And that's generally my rule with anything. If my friend says, hey, let's hang out this weekend, and there are more than three buts associated with that ask, it's probably a no from me. And this can be extrapolated out to your life in terms of your career as well. If you're saying, gosh, there's so much competition, there's layoffs, there is uncertain times, I don't know if this is going to be a stable career for me going forward, I am nervous, I am scared, that is a sign that you should probably be looking at new stuff, that you should be adapting, you should be upskilling, you should be looking at something new. If you take that and you combine it with some of the new trends that we're seeing, AI, the change in the work landscape, new industries coming out left and right, that's an opportunity to me. As much as people are getting laid off, as much as people are facing these incredibly hard times, there is as much opportunity as there was probably in the Great Depression right now. We have as many tools to learn, to teach ourselves, and to share where those folks didn't. And when we look at what Napoleon Hill was talking about, he wrote his book right after the Great Depression. And obviously telling people that they can take control of their life and become a millionaire is not going to be easy to do following the Great Depression. And it's not going to be easy to do in today's times either. But we have a lot more at our fingertips than some of the times and some of the stuff that Napoleon Hill's time was working with. They didn't even have cell phones or social media. So when you look at that, there are plenty of opportunities to take and learn and to change, right? If you don't embrace these principles, though, that's when you're putting yourself at risk. People who resist change fall behind. Those who embrace it thrive. Adversity should be viewed as a forcing function for growth. It should push you to say, oh, okay, what can I learn or what can I be better at? And when we have a fixed mindset, that might be a death sentence. Reinvention is the only way to succeed in this case. The greatest successes, if we look at Ford, Edison, if we look at some of the men on the wager who made it home, if we look at Napoleon, if we look at Ford, all of them were cases of persistence through adaptation, not just sheer willpower. Now back to my professor. As I said at the start of that, when he said be adaptable, I was miffed. I was not happy about this. It really bothered me for a couple of years. About 15 years on from the subject, maybe 10 years later, I can safely tell you that that was the best piece of advice that I have ever received. And the reason is, besides all of the evidence I've given you here today, is that this piece of advice has proven more true for me than any singular piece of advice that I've ever received. The theme of my young career has been to be adaptable. And so at the start, when I say, you know what, this guy might be a bit of a moron, I don't really like what he's saying, and he's not really put a lot of effort into his response to me, I am actually incredibly grateful for that original piece of advice. And that did form the backdrop of why I wanted to share the episode with you today. So thanks for listening. Let me know what you think about the topic. Let me know if there's anything that maybe I've missed here in, as far as the adaptability conversation. Again, I'm just one guy, and this is just one opinion. But I'd be happy to learn what other people are thinking. So let me know in the comments down below. And thank you again for listening to my episode today. Take care.